Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 212. My name is Cameron English. I'm your host, joined as always by Dr. Kevin Folta. Kevin, what's going on? How are you?
Oh, doing great. Just having to get used to the idea that summer is here early. It's April. No, it's beginning of April, and we're in the 90s, mid-90s, which is insane. And it's
Really?
It's been a battle for keeping plants alive. And so it's been spending a lot of time on rethinking irrigation and how to make things more efficient, which is what I get to do when I get home from work. But all good. You know, teaching's been fun. Semester's winding down. Students are on fire. Looks really good. So
that's exciting. And hopefully Nimrod is not around to torture you this week.
Nimrod is not around to torture me at class. Yeah, for those of you who caught last week, today we will have a cat-free experience.
Our producer was editing the episode last week, and he sends me a text and says, "Ha ha 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 ha! Should I edit out the cat part?" And I said, "No,
no, by no means will you edit out the cat part.
You got to humanize
it. I just edited out the cat. He's outside playing in the street, and that's where he'll stay. So all good.
All right. Well, with that out of the way, let's jump into our stories. We've got three, as always. First up, rethinking the clean cosmetics movement. It's reductive to think that just because it's biotech, it's inherently more sustainable. Next, England becomes the first European country to approve gene editing of plants and animals. And finally, 30% more meat. Switching off just one gene with CRISPR produces animals with larger muscles. All right, Kevin, so let's start from the top. What's the clean cosmetics movement, and what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I really like this article a lot because it really lines up with concepts we've talked about in other areas like food, but it applies it to cosmetics. And it was written by Erica Stadler for Refinery 29, and she did a beautiful job in this article about asking an important question. What is really sustainable? And when we're talking about cosmetics, it's a little different than food because food is necessary. Cosmetics, I don't use them. it's one of these things where we don't really think about regenerative cosmetics, right? It's kind of a one-way trip. And in the process of doing that, manufacturers and marketers have done a lot of the same tricks that they've done in food, is they've come up with this idea of clean cosmetics or, you know, all natural or not GMO cosmetics. And the idea here is by kind of getting people to think that somehow the cosmetics that come from natural sources are better for you. And there's the article was really nice because it had a couple of eye-opening experiences, and kind of just start in the beginning, is that when you're trying to generate cosmetics with extracts of algae or rare plants, you know, maybe things on the endangered species list, are you really being more sustainable? And is the idea of generating something in a laboratory maybe cleaner? And as it turns out, it really is. And that lab-derived ingredients really do have not only better performance frequently in cosmetics, but better uniformity in the formulation of cosmetics, but also are less likely to be contaminated with other stuff and have lower impacts on the environment. And the article, one of the surprising things is the social costs, because by putting certain ingredients that are natural, and the example the article gives is mica to give a little more shimmer in certain cosmetics, that you have to have people mine mica, which is being done in rather hideous conditions in India. So I'm all for someone, you know, going the, you know, natural or small, clean, whatever, that's great. But what the article really asks us to do is say, what does sustainable really mean? and solicit or patronize the companies that are emphasizing sustainability rather than fearful marketing campaigns.
So it's so interesting that it's almost the exact opposite of what people perceive. And they talk about this in the story about, you mentioned clean, but even organic, apparently there's certified organic makeup. I didn't know that was a thing. But organic, clean, all natural. And the perception is that these are so much better for the planet because they're natural, right? Natural's good. Natural stuff is good. But it's exactly the opposite. And so I want to talk about some of the specifics. So for example, there's no soil involved when you're producing these ingredients in the laboratory. There's no pesticides because there's no plants you have to protect from pests. And there's much less water use. So this is a significant step up. And so I don't want people to start putting, you know, sustainable labels on products like this. But nonetheless, these really are an important step in the right direction. And then, of course, there's other labor benefits, but maybe we can talk about that in a minute. But talk about those specifics a little bit.
Well, one of the big ones was the rare and endangered species that right. give the best examples of ingredients for plants or for cosmetics. And when you're out harvesting or when they create a need for these things, that folks will wander into into rainforests or other endangered, vulnerable environments to gather the crops that they can get a significant premium for. And so there's a lot of brands that are using these kinds of naturally sourced ingredients that come from certain places that are only grown in a small niche of an ecosystem. And those end up causing more problems by endangering those plants. So it mentions that some of these in the article specifically by name, but you know, the main idea here is that you're driving things to extinction for cosmetics. And or at least endangering or threatening them more. And it doesn't need to be that way. That if we could do it with a genetically engineered microbe, why would we possibly want to harvest everything that's out there in nature? And that's just one really nice example of how it helps to balance out the idea of what is sustainable from what is natural. Two very different things.
Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, but in most cases, it's just one ingredient or maybe one enzyme that you need from these particular plants, right? So if you can just synthesize that in a laboratory or grow it in a genetically engineered bacteria, for example, that's an enormous step up instead of having to grow the entire plant. And again, maybe there are some contradictory examples, but that's my understanding is that you don't really need the entire crop. You just need this, you know, whatever ingredient it happens to produce. Is that right?
That's true. There may be some sort of rare metabolite that's present only in certain plants that is useful in a given cosmetic. And so it really does make a big difference. If you target that one species and offer local folks a king's ransom to go collect as much of it as you can, people do a good job at collecting that. And that has been something that has impacted the presence of specific crops or specific naturally occurring plants that are endangered.
Good stuff. Well, read the whole article. I of course, you should read all the articles that we talk about, but this one is from Refinery 29. It's called "What Are the Human Costs of Sustainable Beauty?" and sustainable in quotes. And this is Erica Stalder for Refinery 29. So really interesting stuff. It's just a great example, I think, as another story we're going to talk about in a minute is, of technology improving sustainability and even the quality of the products and the access that people have to them in some cases. So really good stuff. All right, Kevin, let's talk about, and we mentioned this last week just in passing, England has just approved gene editing in plants, hopefully soon to be followed by animals. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I really wanted to do this one because I know you have a lot of good feedback on this from the article that you had written a few weeks ago, but it's done. It's the Genetic Technology Act has been passed into law. And what's really neat about that is that it was passed in the law, that they didn't have King Charles Homeopathy throwing this one under the bus. Because now what it means is that the UK can develop and market gene-edited crops. And England's first country in Europe to be able to do this now. And that's huge because the European Court of Justice has put the brakes on this technology, meaning that the EU is going to fall behind significantly And what it means now is that Europe, or the EU scientists, or I shouldn't say EU, UK's scientists are now free to really look at application. How can we really focus on getting problems for the planet and problems for people by dealing, by integrating the best technologies to solve the problem? And I just think it's super exciting. The article that was here was written by, it was the Game-Changing Genetic Technology Bill passes in the law in England. And this is at the John Innes Center, the John Innes Center website. And John Innes Center is really an elite organization. John Innes Center, and in conjunction with, it's in Norwich, UK, in conjunction with University of Norwich, they do a lot of beautiful work. And there is a murderer's row of outstanding scientists there. And John Innes just does outstanding work. So the folks who are there have been leaders in the area of genetic engineering and putting solutions on the table for agriculture using genetic engineering. And certainly they've been ahead at the tip of the spear in terms of gene editing. And so the gene editing, which is now using site-directed nucleases or this CRISPR-Cas thing and other techniques to be able to specifically make deletions, very low impact, cheap. Everybody can do it relatively fast. This is a great technology to be able to use in solving some important problems for the UK or for all of the EU. But it's going to happen in England first. And it's really exciting that this has passed because it is hopefully going to open the floodgates just a crack where we can start to allow genetic engineering and the researchers throughout Europe to start to integrate these technologies into their solutions for EU farmers.
It's a really good point. And I think that the activists on the other side of this issue, they recognize that this is the first domino to fall. And that's why they've been so adamant in opposing it. And when they talk about this issue, they will talk about GMO 2.0 when talking about CRISPR and some of these other gene editing technologies, which is amusing to me. Because in a way, it's correct to say that this is just another form of genetic engineering. It's a different technique, technically speaking, and you're doing different things. But it's all genetic modification. All breeding is genetic modification, as we've said ad nauseum on the show. But I suspect, I could be totally wrong about this, but I suspect that eventually they're going to open the door to good old school transgenics as well. Because once you have this, you start to get some of the benefits, but then as Kevin, as you well know, and you could speak to this better than I can, there are still limits with gene editing. You know, there's certain things you cannot do for certain traits. You may have to actually move DNA around from different organisms. And I think that they'll probably start to experience that where they'll run up against a wall and they'll go, oh, we want to do this thing. Wait, we haven't allowed the technology. Oh, okay, maybe we need to update our law again, you know? So I think this is going to start tumbling over time. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I'm hopeful. It's a hopeful prediction. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I oftentimes in my talks will liken genetic engineering, well, transgenics versus gene editing as thinking about the genome as a library, you know, like a physical library in your hometown. And transgenics is leaving new information on the shelf. So say sneaking a Playboy into the stacks of the library for the interviews. And then gene editing is more like, so there you're leaving new information, right? You're putting something new on the shelf or maybe taking something out, maybe, you know, taking one book off the shelf and just whipping it out of the library, you know, one or the other, but it's a larger scale change. Gene editing, I always liken to sneaking into the library and erasing the word not out of the Ten Commandments. You know, now it's party time. You completely flip the entire script on that section of the book and change the meaning of the outcomes, right? Now you can covet your neighbor's stuff. And so one of them is used to eliminate right now at this point. Gene editing can basically defeat information that's present in the genome, whereas old school transgenics can either add new information or take out in larger chunks of information. This is a really good analogy because the gene editing is also more precise by nature. You know where it's going to function because it's a target. transgenics, you're dropping things into the genome. They land where they land. You can confirm where they land and understand that they're not in a dangerous part of a genome, but it's not a, you can't control that necessarily. And so there's, you know, a lot of real precision that gene editing brings in. And I think that also is a lot more settling for people as a transitional technology.
One other thing I wanted to address, and this came up incidentally because I restarted my Twitter account and I started doing what Kevin does, where you just go interact with people, as much as I dislike that sometimes. But I started getting into a dialogue with somebody who she reshared some content from GM Freeze, which is a pretty prominent anti-biotech group in England and in the EU, I believe. And they had put up some reports from the British government or from some committee in Parliament that was saying this is going to give DEFRA, which is sort of like our USDA roughly, it's going to give them too much power over the products that farmers can grow and so forth. And I just wanted to address that for a second. I think it's sort of amusing because they're sort of making this libertarian-leaning free market argument about the power of government. And really what they're trying to preserve is a government that can literally tell a farmer, you may not grow this in your own land. And if you're a scientist, you may not do this in your own laboratory, you know, or you can't commercialize this or what have you. So I thought that was sort of amusing. And one other thing to add is that sometimes, like Parliament or Congress, they'll pass a law and they'll say, you know, we don't have the expertise to regulate this product, but we know it needs to be regulated. So according to this law, the FDA or whoever is going to regulate this, and we're going to leave it to them to specify the kind of regulation. And sometimes that can be a problem, but in many cases, and I think this is one of them, you're turning over the issue to the people that do it for a living, right? So it doesn't mean there shouldn't be safeguards and there shouldn't be public comment periods and so forth, like with the chestnut tree we've talked about. But there's nothing necessarily wrong with saying the scientists who study this for a living are going to inform the rules that we have in our country. And I think that trend in England is really, really exciting, as we've said.
Yeah, and that's the beauty about gene editing. I was talking to somebody earlier today, and that this is really a democratizing technology because no one really can figure out who owns it and how to license and all that stuff, which is great. But then on top of that, you have I mentioned before, the ease at which it may be used, the speed at which it may be done, the fact that small governments, in impoverished nations can now have a team of scientists that's doing gene editing to solve an important crop problem in their country. The fact that there are fewer collateral impacts inside the cell. There's so many good reasons why this technology is exciting. And it allows it to be in more hands. It's not going to be just a, Bayer, Monsanto, Dow, Corteva, Syngenta, ChemChina technology like transgenics were. And the only reason transgenics were stuck in those three countries or those three companies was because the regulatory hassles were so high that university of whatever can't do it. And small companies go through a very, very hard time getting through. Ask Okanagan Specialty Foods. And the other point that you made you made another good point, I forgot, but the basic idea is that this is a democratizing technology. You have the ability to get more players who will be in this space using it for different solutions, which is really pretty exciting. Oh, the regulatory hurdles. The regulatory hurdles are much lower because you're not introducing foreign material. In most cases, you're deleting a little bit of what was already there. So you're not doing anything that nature couldn't do on its own. And in frequent cases, nature did. So a great example, genes in barley that they know confer susceptibility to disease, genes in barley, genetic variants in barley that make it resistant to powdery mildew, those gene variants don't exist in wheat. But the wheat gene, same gene exists, just not the variant. So you can take the information from barley and now create it in wheat and find that you can get that same durable resistance in wheat. So you can't cross the two together. So you can't breed that thing in any reasonable way, but you can make a facsimile of it. And damn it, it works. So it's just another way of having more precise editing of genomes to get the traits you need.
Yeah, it's enormous. I mean, because right away the benefits are going to start. You know, gene-edited tomatoes that are good for vitamin D deficiency, which is a serious, not a serious, but it is a real problem in England and in the UK more broadly and so forth, you know. And the technology is there, as you said. You have the Sainsbury Laboratory, John Innes. There's lots of really good people working on this. And it has been a matter of, let us do our job and we can help you. You know, just pass the law so we're not criminals. So we'll leave that there. I want to recommend my report that I wrote back in December for the Institute of Economic Affairs. It's called Harvest Time, Why the UK Should Unleash the Power of Gene Editing. It's been peer-reviewed. I got to talk to Kevin about it on Talking Biotech a few months ago, which was really, really cool. But there's all kinds of good information in there. It's been reviewed by experts. And if you want to sort of catch up on what's going on over there and the arguments that are being made back and forth, I'd highly recommend that. And we're just going to follow this, Kevin, because this is a big development, and I hope we get to see more of it in the future. So let's hone in on a specific example now of something really cool you can do with gene editing that most people probably don't know, and this is making meat meatier effectively. So tell us about this.
Well, this is a really interesting way of which you can emulate a naturally occurring mutation in a organism where that mutation does not exist. So there have been examples of animals over the years that have been what's called double muscled. And the Belgian blue cow is a great example. So if you go to the Belgian blue cow and you look this thing up, or the Belgian blue bull, you look this thing up, it is a massive cow that is just muscles on top of muscles. And the reason that this happens is because of a defect in a gene called myostatin. It's a gene which breaks down muscle tissue. So as if you disrupt the breakdown, all you get is the buildup. And if you go across, people like, you know, there's certain people who put on more muscle mass, you may find variants of myostatin, which are present. And some of us that don't put on good weight that way, maybe it's the opposite. Maybe you find it's more easily, you know, torn down. But the bottom line is that if this gene variant in Belgian blue cattle exists, that if it's missing, allow it to become double muscled. What happens when you do this in a pig or in a tilapia? Or, you know, can you create myostatin negative animals that have more meat mass? And the answer is, yeah, you can do it. And so when they've done this in other organisms, they've done it in pigs, they've done this in tilapia, and you find that you can make animals that have much better retention of muscle and better feed conversion, that you're giving them more, the feed you give them is resulting in more food product. So another example of sustainability, right? You're creating more human product for the same amount of input cost. And that's just one example in the article. They talk about quite a few other examples, but this is just one. But the beautiful part about this is you're taking a naturally occurring gene variant in the Belgian blue cattle, and you're now creating exactly the same thing in other animals to get that double-muscled phenotype. And it just shows how gene editing allows the transfer of information between species and in places where it never has been before.
And this is actually occurring. Some of these products have been commercialized. So one of the things you'll hear from a lot of the critics is that, you know, we can't do this because Jurassic Park or, you know, insert scariest scenario here. And let me read this quote from the article. So this says, in Japan, experts have doubled the muscle yield of red sea bream and pufferfish. These genome-edited fish are now available in the Japanese markets after they've been recognized as no different from conventionally bred fish. So again, it just underscores what we said earlier, but this is already happening in the real world. You have genetically engineered products on the market, and as far as I know, there's no public health crisis in Japan from eating gene-edited fish. So again, this is awesome stuff.
Yeah, all you're doing is changing what has already naturally been done. And it's absolutely nothing nefarious or weird. You're not creating any new chemistry. You're just allowing muscle to be retained that normally would be turned over at some degree. And that's fantastic. So it means that your amount of food you put into it, the amount of time, the amount of antibiotics, the amount of whatever it takes to raise animals. And I mean antibiotics because they talk about fish. And, you know, fish sometimes do get some diseases in fish farms. All the resources that you need to raise those animals now become more valuable because they're being used to create more outcome. And that's the basis of sustainability. It really changes when you start looking at ways in which gene editing can affect disease. And a really great example in here is PRRS, which we've talked about on Talking Biotech, which is a porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome. And it affects a lot of pigs, commercial swine, and has a significant cost to producers. I mean, it's huge. I don't have the number, but it's billions. And if you can affect, and they know they can do this now, you can gene edit the target where the virus docks with the cell. And if you edit that out, the animal can no longer be infected. A lot like the guy in China did with the two girls who can't get HIV. He was able to gene edit the receptor for the virus. They did the same thing here. And so now the animals can survive in the presence of the virus, and they don't spread it as much, you would guess, because the virus isn't actively being cultured. I don't know. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I don't know what the status of that is. But the animals survive without a problem. And so this is a really exciting kind of use of this particular technology.
Really, really cool. One other example that I think I'd love to talk more about in the future, Kevin, is there's labs, and the one I'm looking at now is the University of Minnesota. They're looking at genetically editing or gene editing invasive species of fish. And I forget which river it is, but there's a major river in the US that's used as a thoroughfare for trade. And the only way they can keep this particular species of invasive fish out is to put an electric gate straight down the middle of the river. It sounds like you know what I'm talking about. So they have to have multiple gates like this up because they have to keep them electrified at all times, but they have to renovate them and, you know, repair them and so forth. And that's the only way to keep these fish away from other species that we depend on for, you know, food and economic trade and so forth. And so what this lab is doing is they're trying to, it hasn't been commercialized yet, but what they're doing is they're engineering these fish so that when they reproduce, their offspring die. And that's really significant that if you can breed these things to take over where all the wild ones are, they're going to wipe themselves out, you know? So that's a big sustainability benefit. I can't imagine anybody is pro having giant electric fences in the middle of rivers, right? So the sky's the limit, I guess, is all I'm saying here.
Yeah, that's a grass carp, and a Asian Asian carp. The Asian carp, not the grass carp. The Asian carp is endemic now in the Mississippi and Illinois rivers, right, and is heading towards the Great Lakes. And so it would get in through Illinois, and so the big deal now is how do you keep it out? And I think they've detected the DNA for it already in the Great Lakes. But it would displace other species like you wouldn't believe. I mean, this thing is highly, highly invasive. And who knows? Right now they're managing it by electric shock and electrofishing, but even that's a losing battle. So the idea of using a gene drive to be able to drive it down, it may be one really good application of a gene drive. It's hard to say, but all these things are really, really good uses of these technologies.
Exciting stuff. Exciting stuff. We'll see what happens with that, but I'm hopeful. Again, it's just the need that this addresses seems like it's bigger than whatever invented concerns that we have to battle against. So we'll see what changes. Okay, we're going to call the show. Thank you for joining us. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, at Kevin Folta. You can follow me personally. I finally am back on Twitter. It's just at CamJ English. If you have questions about the show or you want to interact, we're both happy to talk to you. And then follow Genetic Literacy Project as well. They're just at Genetic Literacy. As I say every time, they put this on for us. They put it on all the platforms. And with that, we will see you guys next week for episode 213. See you next time.